services. I'm pinch hitting for the chair because he is in D.C. that he said I could cast a proxy for him on any bill I wanted. Unfortunately, he didn't inform me that I was going to be chairing the committee until it was too late to gotten stuff any of these bills. So we are not going to be hearing Senate Bill 326 today. We need another amendment on the bill. As I understand, it's an agreed-upon amendment. And I also understand there may be some issues with LFO. So we will hold that over till Monday. By then we should have the amendment. So I will open a work session on Senate Bill 170.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Senate Bill. Explain where we're at here.
Senate Bill 170. The committee heard this bill on April 4th. It updates various provisions related to the authority of the State Board of Massage Therapists. The committee has seen the Dash 1 amendment, which is still before you. It restores human in the definition of massage and clarifies that any person licensed by an Oregon State regulatory body who's acting within the scope of that license and practicing massage is exempt from the regulatory authority of the board. There was concern that arose at that hearing that clients could actually be penalized for aiding, abetting, or assisting a person practicing massage without a license. So you also now have before you the Dash 3 amendment, which clarifies that persons who are exclusively clients who provide referrals to a massage therapist cannot be considered to be aiding, abetting, or assisting a person practicing massage.
Okay. Any questions of the committee on Dash 1 or Dash 3 amendments?
I haven't seen them.
Has everybody found their Dash 1 and Dash 3 amendments? While we're pondering, maybe we'll have these two young ladies kind of fill in the void here.
I don't know if we like that idea.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Massage Therapy Association of Oregon, and with me today is Patty Glenn, who's the executive director of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapy, and it is indeed her bill, but as you know, Patty and I work jointly with those of you on the amendment, answering some questions, and we're hoping that we got everyone to see that the intentions are all well and good, and the changes that other people wanted to specific parts of the bill we have in fact made.
Any questions of the committee as relative to the concerns that were expressed at the last hearing?
Well, I'm just hoping it takes care of it. It looks like it does.
I think so. Senator Berger, I think so, too. I think it does take care of those concerns.
Mr. Chair, for clarification, we would need adoption of the Dash 1s and the Dash 3s so
correct.
That we can take care of everyone's concerns.
Correct. Okay. Senator Morris Anderson, would you be so kind as to make
yes,
motions?
I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 170.
Senator Mona Sanderson moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 170. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 170.
Senator Mona Sanderson moves the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 170. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 170 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Mona Sanderson moves Senate Bill 170 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Call the roll.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Ron
Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Booth?
Aye. I'll say he's excused.
Bless you.
Thank you very much. Senate Bill 170, having received a constitutional majority, has passed on the way to the floor. And just for the heck of it, I will carry the bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We'll be happy to provide you with some talking points.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I will close the work session on Senate Bill 170. Are you ready to take off on this, or do you want to? Okay. The committee will stand at ease momentarily. Well, I think you went to see if you could get Margaret. So, Human Services Committee, and I'm going to open public hearings on Senate Bill 1031, Senate Bill 931, and Senate Bill 930 simultaneously.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is John Christensen, and I serve as staff in the office of Senator Margaret Carter, President Pro Tem of the Senate. Senate Bill 930, 931, and 1031 are part of a series of bills that grew out of an initiative from the Department of Human Services on child obesity and the prevention of child obesity. 930 was based on a model from Louisiana, which provides for optional insurance coverage for individuals that may have a condition of morbid obesity. Senate Bill 931 creates a task force for comprehensive obesity prevention, or an initiative on comprehensive obesity, and sets forth the membership for that task force. Senator Carter has been working with the director of DHS, the Department of Human Services, in refining that specific bill, and we are working currently on modest amendments to change that. The director of DHS has also advised us that the bill would have no fiscal impact because he could do it within the range of his current budget or anticipated budget. Senate Bill 1031 grows or arises out of a recommendation from a recent state commission or task force report on what the state could do to promote healthy living and healthy eating. And it recommended, required guidelines for restaurants and also for the Department of Agriculture on food products. We went to LC and we talked to them about our current statutes, and we found that in the view of Senator Carter, that the penalties were too severe. It was tied into a code that, the way they initially wrote it, that would be putting restaurant owners in jail and things like that. So we essentially took out the requirement and made the concept voluntary. That's essentially the three bills. The one bill that is moving in terms of maybe projecting forward is 931, which is with the director of DHS and setting up a comprehensive obesity prevention initiative. Thank you.
Senator Cruz and members of the committee, Senator Lou Henrich. I am the executive director of Community Health Partnership, Oregon's Public Health Institute, and John asked if I would accompany him today to just generally talk to the complexity of the issue of obesity, childhood obesity, and then even beyond that into adulthood, and the severity of the problem, which I think you are hearing over and over in many venues about the individual costs, the community costs, the economic costs, if we don't get a hold of and try to turn the tide back. Either next week or the following week, depending on scheduling, you will be hearing House Bill 2650, which is the school nutrition standards bill dealing with what we're able to sell in schools. So that is a piece certainly talking to all of you and your colleagues, this is not the full answer. You know, this one thing is not going to turn the tide, but it's an important first step, and we'll speak to that. But there are many other pieces that, some of which I think the professionals dealing with this and the public and the elected officials kind of have some common sense approaches, but I don't know that we really yet have a clear blueprint and plan that everybody is bought into. It's kind of like, what if we had it, you know, I mean, what would it really look like? And how would we stage it? What are the first priorities? What things are policy? What things are incenting people to do the right thing? I mean, a whole variety of strategies, and I think that the department's recently released, it's not called childhood obesity, it's called positively affecting nutrition and physical activity, but the report that recently came out from that was commissioned by the Oregon Health Policy Commission and done by DHS and others really does lay out a whole variety of recommendations, and those recommendations can either kind of sit in a report and gather dust, and a few kind of advocate types like me and a few others that'll keep running around saying, but remember this, we think this is the answer. We need to just keep the movement going forward and get the best thinking and a real state plan around this. And so we're just saying, as a policy and advocacy organization that is very concerned with these issues, that we stand ready to help out in any way we can, and we applaud Senator Carter for saying that let's raise this to the level where the legislature says this is serious. We know that we're taking steps this time, but we aren't going to get there all the way, and we need to have people working on this to bring back for the next session. Are there other policy recommendations and things that we can get agreement on? And I'm sorry, Senator Cruz. I feel like
it's the air in the building, I think.
It's the nurse in me, Senator Cruz. I'm wanting to come up and try to give you a little TLC. So anyway, that's really why I'm here today, and I'm honored to have been asked by Senator Carter's office to come.
Mr. Chair, just to interject, I also have with me formal comments from Senator Carter, which we'd like to have entered into the record. There are some specific comments I'd like to add. State Representative Scott Brun, Republican colleague from West Lynn, he used to work. We now have an explosion of type 2 diabetes in Oregon. Obesity has tripled as a circumstance in the last 20 years in Oregon. In addition, diabetes, one of the recent issues of the Economist magazine, which is a highly respected magazine, estimated that approximately $150 billion alone is dedicated to diabetes in the American economy. And the article was featured the epidemic. So this is a serious issue that it's affecting us in terms of our health costs, in terms of our delivery system, our children. And we need to get ahead of it. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead.
Senator Berger.
Thank you very much. Thank you, both of you, for your presentations today, and to Senator Carter. This is a really serious subject. The thing about diabetes is that so many people have it and don't know it.
Yes.
And that is always scary to me, that you would have something that is as serious as diabetes. But looking at the bills, I just wanted to ask a couple of questions.
Yes, ma'am. Sorry.
So that what you are, your goal,
yes, ma'am,
can be reached by these three bills, that you really get some movement here and accomplish it. In Senate Bill 931, which establishes a task force, one of your comments is that outreach is so important.
Yes, ma'am.
And that you had been working with the First Lady. Now, when you say that, so that I clearly understand you, does that mean that the task force would be
the group that would go out, like, for public hearings, or would this task force try to do other things, like educational materials that could be handed out? Would they be going into schools? What did you have in mind there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, Senator Berger, I think that's an excellent question, and actually that is what Senator Carter is currently working with the Director of DHS on, which is 931, as it currently is drafted, is essentially a placeholder, and the membership is being modified a tad bit, not a lot, but being modified a tad bit to become more inclusive. Senator Carter's discussion with the First Lady specifically dealt with how can we bring minority women, minorities, communities that are not generally always caught within broad brush of way things can happen.
Sure.
Senator Carter is very active in sororities and links a lot of women's organizations within various communities, and that was the concept, to try to be more inclusive and to bring these parties to a table. Diabetes runs rampant in the African American community. Obesity, high blood pressure, heart disease. The average age for an African American male, for example, even in life, is 65. So most African American males never collect Social Security. You know, these are the kinds of dimensions and statistics that exist within certain communities that I think Senator Carter wants to reach. And that's why she's modifying this a tad bit.
All right. Thank you for that answer, John.
Thank you.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair? The next one is Senate Bill 1031. And when you talk about the caloric content, and that does address obesity, but trying to stay on a sugar-free diet, as I do, and I'm not diabetic, but I do try to stay sugar-free. So were you thinking of having the sugar content of foods listed as well? Because that'd be very helpful to people like me.
Can I let the nurse answer the question?
All right.
She's working.
Senator Cruz, Senator Berger, I think that the concept of menu labeling and making the public able to know what it is that they're eating and make choices based on that, I think there's still discussion about how to do it practically, how, you know, if you have it on menu boards, my God, how big does this board have to be? What do you include? But I think the kind of the consensus as I'm hearing it and reading and talking with people seems to be calories, fat, and sugar, and sodium seem to be the four things that people are most, you know, some are more passionate on one mm-hmm. or the other, and then also the issue that keeps coming up on trans fat. And as the industry moves to really get trans fat kind of out of our products, that's probably something that I've been told by the industry and the restaurant industry too, is that that is happening, as you know. So by the time we ever got something done, I'm not sure whether that has to be listed on its own, but I think that issue of kind of those major things is what would have to be really discussed and put together and something that's practical and reasonable, but gets people, and some of that is that outreach. What is it that people want to know about what they're eating and the content of that food, and then kind of what is able to be listed out fairly easily and practically, and those. And so I think part of it would be that it isn't exactly decided, but I think sugar is one that I certainly hear about.
Last comment, Mr. Chair. Well, I think that the marketplace is very helpful in that, because there's sugar-free candy, sugar-free
yes.
cookies, sugar-free, but they label things very mm-hmm. nicely. And if
yes.
you're trying to avoid certain elements, and it would be nice, and I'm sure restaurants do have low sugar in some of their mm-hmm. things as well, that it would give you a nice choice. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ma'am, to elaborate a tad bit, my mom happens to be diabetic. My brother, who recently passed away, was also diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Senator Carter had a sister who just passed away, was diabetic, and she's had two nephews in the last 6 months
right.
that died from diabetes. that's a good start. Sugar, which is diabetes, fat, which is heart disease, sodium, which is blood pressure, high blood pressure, and trans fat, which I'm sure Dr. Bates, who's introduced legislation, would probably like to see that on the list too. But those four are excellent starting points, I think.
The M&Ms in my office are sugar-free, by the way. Senator George.
Well, as a former sugar beet grower, I can tell you sugar is natural, but those substitutes are not, and there's a lot of side effects coming about with those, so I hope we keep this in balance.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I would want to talk to you guys about that I'm beginning to believe may be the key, and I'm going to share with you what I heard over the weekend. I'm listening to this program, and they're interviewing this psychiatrist, and he's talking about, particularly within children and many of the things that we're giving, and many times psychotropic drugs, because, you know, of their behavioral problems and stuff like that. And what they found out was is that the drugs had exactly the same impact on that child's behavior and everything else as an exercise regimen. That they, with exercise, those children achieved the same stabilization of their mental well-being and their disciplinary. And so you're sitting here thinking, we're about to reinvent the wheel, because they taught us 1, 2, 3, 4 by showing you the four food groups, and these are good. You want to do these. Now, we can incorporate that kind of stuff again. And, you know, today, I mean, what happened to PE? Whatever happened to that? You see kids just sitting around all the time. And I can remember when I was fat with glasses when I was a kid, to grow up and get into middle school and high school and become, you know, lean. Okay, and the reason was is we had programs that encourage you to do that. So the bottom line, and then I reverted back in time to where I have glasses again, and now we're no longer skinny. But the point of it is that seems to be, to me, a really major key. In fact, next week we're going to be having a hearing,
mm-hmm.
and downstairs we're going to be talking about what kind of alternative practices can we do to encourage people, and I'm doing it myself, to start thinking in terms of good health. You guys listed food processors, and the first thing I thought was, okay, that reminds me of a circumstance when I was in a health food store about 2 weeks ago, and she says, well, Gary, you might want to think about eating products like, you know, the Mediterranean diet, including fruit and nuts. And she said, hazelnuts are really, really good. And I said, you know what? Guess what I grow? And then I said, guess what I don't eat? And so there are many things that it just takes raising awareness in order to get these kids back on track. The other thing that I would think ought to be on that way or warning label is MSG.
This is just a diversion. First of all, with regard to sugar, Senator, I want you to know my mom has a little checklist, and if it's above a certain level, 20s or rather than 10s, when it comes to sugar content in food, she doesn't eat it. And that's the kind of guide that people have to have. With regard to the exercise and medications, my wife is in pediatrics, and there are actually regiments and schools of thought rising in Europe, particularly in France, where they're using exercise as a counter to some of the medications, and it's being looked at seriously. What was the third thing?
Okay, MSG, monosodium
glutamate. I also know practitioners that work with migraine headaches, and MSG is part of that equation too. And there are folks that do not, if they consciously are aware that they're eating MSG, will not do so because it may be a instigator with migraines.
Here, if I could, just a little. It's really a follow-up on my comments, not on questions. I'm sorry, but I would like a response from you guys. I listened again to an expert talking about MSG and the impact, particularly on children, and what they believe was a permanent impact upon the brain of children that were exposed to this, only to go into my closet, and this is why I'm saying the educational portion of this thing, and everything I took down off of the shelf, monosodium glutamate, all of the partners with MSG were in so many of those products. And so I know we want it to taste really terrific, but you know that, I don't know if you guys are aware, but that really doesn't change the taste. It tricks your brain to thinking that it tastes better. So I think this raising awareness of healthful eating is smart all over. So,
thank you, Senator. I will, and this is just a comment, add to you on your comment that MSG also comes in natural forms. And it doesn't just come as an additive. There are some foods, for instance, mushrooms, that have MSG in it and other products. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 930. I'll reopen it in a minute, but we have folks testify on Senate Bill 931 and 1031, so we will deal with that now, and that will be Melcon and Jim Lace, please.
Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to testify today. Just to build on the testimony that's already been said, you have my, or will shortly have my written testimony. The two bills I want to speak to are 931 and 1031, and they both, as has already been noted, arise out of the recommendations from the task force report that we staffed for the Health Policy Commission. The report's called Promoting Physical Activity and Health and Nutrition Among Oregon's Youth. I would note that there were three recommendations that the work group identified as the top three. One of them was the need for physical education standards, in school that Senator George referred to, the bill that's going to be heard. The second is the school nutrition standards that Ms. Henrich referred to as well and that has been moving along. And the third is captured, I think, in Senate Bill 931. And that was to create a statewide comprehensive obesity prevention program analogous to the very effective program that we have for tobacco prevention. In order to do this, however, this is going to require some political will. And I think that this task force that this bill would create has the potential to help create that political will and figure out a strategy for bringing about the creation of that program and effort, and that's why we're supporting it. I know that there are some small wording changes that Dr. Goldberg has been talking with Senator Carter about, and we're fully supportive of all of those, and I'm quite sure that we'll be able to work through those. I think Senator Carter's been very open to the concerns that we've had, and I think we'll be able to solve those in a way that we'll be satisfied with. With regard to Senate Bill 1031, this, as has already been noted, was another recommendation that came out of the report, was the need for, it's essentially consumer information. There's good research out there that shows that even experts like nutritionists, when they go into a restaurant, looking at what's presented to them on the menu, aren't really able to accurately gauge how many calories are going to be in what they're going to be eating. So if nutritionists can't do this, how are the rest of us supposed to be able to do it? And how could we make informed choices without that kind of information available to us? So what we would do under this bill is to survey other states and talk with experts in the field and try to come up with some voluntary guidelines that would lay out what might be some of the best ways for restaurants to convey this information to consumers. We would then make this information available on our website and work with some of our other partners to disseminate this information to restaurateurs. So, again, we're supportive of this bill. I think it's a step forward. I would like to... I think it'll be really important to learn about what other states are doing and then to look critically at what we've put together and see what the best way is to get that, to make that happen here in Oregon restaurants. So thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Dr. Lace.
Senator Cruz and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician from Salem, and I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. I actually don't have any written testimony. We've testified in support before of PE. This is a big issue for us in terms of taking care of our children, junk food bills that we've testified on before. These, I think, follow along the same line, which is any way we can start to deal with that issue. For us, in the trenches, if you will, the people that have to deal with these children in our office every day, and then for my colleagues in the adult world that deal with the adults every day, it's a big issue. And there's a lot of tax money that goes out every year dealing with it. We have some very simple take-home messages for our families in terms of what they can do. These things are much more comprehensive, but you're talking about PE. We, you know, if you call my office, you're going to be on hold for a while. Not always, but if you do, then you're going to hear me going blah, blah, blah. But there's going to be one part of it, which is the same thing I've been saying for the last 2 years. You know, we're trying to limit children to 2 hours on the TV or on the computer, 60 minutes a day, well, 30 to 60 minutes a day of something, some kind of physical activity, and then to start looking at what they eat. In fact, we don't tell them to go to get rid of the sugar in the diet, because you can't really do that. What you do is you modify what you take in, what kind of sugars that you look at. And so there's some very simple take-home measures, but it's a big issue. These bills look good to us. I mean, whether they are going to come out modified in whatever form. But I think as a society, the more we can do to start dealing with this, they help people be informed about how they consume their foods, what kind of foods they consume, and how what they do with their bodies is huge. We have... I have my stable of kids that have BMIs over 50 and 55 now. Just to give you an idea, you know, we call overweight the 25.5 to 30, and then we get into the obese category of over 30, and then you're morbidly obese if you get over 40. You get over 50, you're really in trouble. And what happens when you get over the 40, you're talking about 80% of those kids ending up with type 2 diabetes. When you get up over 50, it's almost a guarantee that you're going to end up with that. All the money that the state spends, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 million a year treating obesity-related conditions, if we can do anything to prevent that, to slow that down, makes a huge impact. So I think this is a beginning, and we're going to be back, I'm sure, session after session dealing with this, because this is not a problem that's going away. It's somewhat akin to our meth epidemic, and we as a society have to figure out some tools to kind of come to grips with that. And so I think these are two beginners. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moss Anderson.
And this comes from personal experience. In grade school, we bought our lunch.
Mm-hmm. You bought your lunch, or you bought it?
We bought it in the cafeteria, mm-hmm. and the only foods I can remember ever having are macaroni and cheese, mm-hmm. and gravy, biscuits and gravy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were... That's the kind of food we had in grade school. It was cheap to make, and the kids liked to eat it.
Yes.
And yet, we were all sort of thin. But we played tetherball, and I remember marbles. We loved playing marbles.
You probably walked the school both ways.
Oh, yeah, in the snow and sleet and hail.
And it was probably uphill both ways, too. So.
But truly, changing food, it may help.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't really address getting out and having an active life, no matter what we do, we're still going to have obesity. The amount of pop, I see parents giving pop to their 2 and 3 year olds, and it's a change in the kinds of food that we eat and change in our lifestyle. And another proof is
and how you think about it. Because the people don't think about it. For example, just to go to the Burger King, McDonald's, just have a simple meal, nothing special, not supersized meal or anything like that, that's 1,375 calories for a burger, fries, and a shake. And then you're hungry in 3 or 4 hours again, and you don't even think that you had that 1,300 calories. Our bodies are, as you notice, our bodies are designed to run as if we're going to not have food tomorrow. We eat now, store it up, and we're ready for whatever happens. Well, we keep storing it up and storing it up and storing it up, but we never get a chance to use it up. So, anyway, sorry.
No. And then follow-up, I was an exchange student to Greece in high school, and I gained 30 pounds in about 4 months. And that's because the lifestyle there is so slow and nice and calm. And
that's the Mediterranean diet.
And the Mediterranean diet. But I was not as active. We didn't have the sports there. We didn't have the swimming there and things that I was used to doing. So it's definitely more than just food.
We have to use up those calories. I mean, that's what it's all about. And if we don't change our ways to get to school, we don't have safer urban environments for getting out and having kids exercise, we're still going to be back here session after session trying to figure out how to modify society, how can we improve that, and how can we give more access to our children to use up those calories. Because there's always two parts. You got your intake, you got your output. If you got too much in the intake, you're going to store it up. That's what we do. That's what we're designed. And even all the drugs, if you ever listen to Dr. Marks up at the university, there's at least 64 different pathways to make sure that you keep eating. You can take a drug and say, we're going to cut this one off. We're going to do leptin. Okay, we got this. Okay, Well, there's 60 other three that are going to kick in because our bodies are too clever. We're just designed to survive, and we're designed to survive in really bad conditions, famine, oh, awful things. But because we figure out how to get some food in and how to store it. And we do that over and over and over again. And so it has to be a bigger issue. It has to be done on a societal level. So, anyway.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I want to share with you guys something that happened over the weekend. one of my grandsons, just turned 6, okay? And so his mom and dad, and along with their physician, have been trying to get him to lose a little weight, you know, because he's starting to look more like grandpa. And so, anyway, we're riding in a golf cart, and the dog was riding with us, you know, in the golf cart. And then the dog got out, and Ben said to me, you know, Charlie needs to be running because he's getting a little fat. and I said, yeah, that's true. And pretty soon he said, would you stop the golf cart, Grandpa? Yeah, sure. So I stopped, and he gets out. I said, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm going to run from here back home. And I said, well, that's a great idea because you want to try to lose some weight and get some exercise. That's correct. But then I pointed out that he couldn't do that because he had cut his toe and he was wearing a pair of thongs, and so you couldn't run like that. So, but he was very upset that he had to get back into the golf cart and ride with Grandpa because he was convinced that he was going to have to get that exercise going in order to deal with his weight problem. So, you know, it's really amazing how quickly kids pick up the idea of proper behavior, and he's the same way with his eating habits now. Well, Grandpa, I can't have that with you over here, you know. We don't need sugar on that cereal.
Well, getting PE back into our schools in a regular format, in an organized manner, the kids get used to doing that. It gets to be a mindset. Mm-hmm. And so they don't have to be Olympic athletes. They don't have to be members of the teams or anything, but just to get them there. Exercise more. You got to start young and build it into the whole mindset and the whole educational approach.
So. Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think that there's something else that needs to be added here. I believe that besides just the obesity part of it, exercise not only makes you slim, but it makes you mentally feel better. And I think that people that suffer with depression, you know, if I just sat on a couch, I think I'd get depressed too. So I think there is, the more you do, the more you can do. The more active you are, the stronger you get. So you get a lot of strength from it. And then also I think young people suffer with low self-esteem who are overweight. And I think that other kids tease them, and they just don't feel as good about themselves. And so I think there's just a lot to be added to the whole mental health kind of problem that comes from our solutions that come from good exercise and food.
Yeah. And there's no question that children who are active learn better. There's good data. Nobody would argue with that at all. And the whole issue about childhood depression, self-imagery, that's a big, big issue for these children. Yeah. And all they do is they cycle in deeper because then they don't want to go out and they
well,
don't
they
want
to exercise.
Get involved. Well, they get the new... I just learned to play the new Wii game this weekend. Somebody had one, so I got a little more exercise instead of just sitting there with the thumbs. So.
Okay. Well, you know, we've never had any use for our thumbs, but this generation found one.
Senator Berger, you make a good point. The longer I sit in this building, the more depressed I get. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you both very much. I'm going to close the public hearings on Senate Bill 931 and 1031 and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 930 and call it Kathy Ramey.
Thank you, Chairman Cruz, members of the committee. I came specifically to address Senate Bill 930. I think that this is a if you have the sheet where we signed up, you'll see that I put a question mark under yes and marked that I'm neutral, and I kind of thought, well, maybe I should also mark
Kathy,
no.
Could you state your name for the record?
Yes,
please.
My name is Kathy Ramey.
Thank you.
All right. So I'm ambivalent about this bill. It's what I call a good start, maybe. As I understand this bill and as I've read through the bill, I have some objections to it. I would object to the term optional in section one of the bill. I think that we are at the point where we can come out of the dark ages with regard to weight management and what insurance companies should provide in terms of assistance to those people who are really struggling with weight. I don't think it should be an option to define away an entire group of people based upon obesity, any more than we would say we're no longer going to cover cardiac surgery for people who have been eating French fries for 20 years, or we're not going to cover lung chemotherapy for lung cancer for those who've smoked. There are biological, genetic, and behavioral components in all of these disease processes. Obesity is a disease process. As we've heard earlier today, it's one that is threatening children, and it's threatening our nation. It's a very serious problem. And so I am very much opposed to the term optional. Insurance companies should be obligated to treat the obese just as they treat people with other forms of illness. Moving on through the bill, there is a, in section, well, it looks like it's in section 2, number 2, there is the statement that, or excuse me, let me go down further. Let's see. Yes, it is section 2, number 2. It says, non-surgical medical treatment of morbid obesity supervised by a physician has been unsuccessful for at least 18 months. I would remove that requirement of 18 months. I think that 6 months may be reasonable. 18 months is a burden. Right now, here in Oregon, health insurance companies, with a very few exceptions, do not cover treatment for obesity. And so when a patient goes in, they are paying their own freight. They're paying their own bill if they go in for treatment for obesity, if they're looking to get assistance, medical assistance with a diet program, with any kind of ongoing supervision for weight. And so to say that they have to have a supervised plan for 18 months is a burden that makes it untenable for a lot of people then to meet the criteria. And so I would exclude that.
Question, though.
Senator Morris Anderson.
As a nurse, I always think that you should always try non-invasive treatments first. And I had to go on some medication, and I gained a lot of weight because of that. But then I worked with a physician and diet, and it took me a year to lose the weight. And I think that was the intent, to make sure that under proper supervision of adequate nutrition, that
that might be the best way to try first rather than...
Right, and I'm not disagreeing with that, but when we're talking about, with this particular bill, 930, you're talking about people who are morbidly obese, really. They're people who can no longer go shopping comfortably and stand on their feet for 20 minutes, a half an hour, whatever it takes, in order to get the grocery shopping done, their errands run, and so forth. You're talking about people here in Salem who can't leave their house because they have so much body mass that they're dealing with that they don't have the energy. They no longer have the ability to walk 2-3 blocks to get exercise. And so this is talking about a group of people who are really, they've tried Weight Watchers, they've tried a diet with coaxing from their physician in every way they know how. But as somebody who has struggled with weight all of my life and who has been through the mill with physicians, I know that my health insurance company, when my physician would say, I want to refer you to a particular program for weight management, my health insurance company said, no, we don't cover that. We don't cover anything for weight management over and over again. And so that makes it very difficult. And for some people can, over the space of a year, they're going to lose weight. But the reality is there are a lot of people who have not been successful in that way. And there has to be some way to address the medical needs of that segment of the population. And not to treat them as some sort of a lesser class in with regard to medical insurance. And that's really what we have. We have a situation where if you are terribly ill with lung cancer because you've smoked for 40 years, they'll pull out all the stops to cover whatever treatment you need. If you're very, very ill with some other disease, they'll pull out all the stops. If you are very ill with obesity, they'll treat each symptom separately, which is a tremendous amount of money that we're spending. But they will not go right to the core of the problem and say, let's do something that's going to make a significant difference in your life, and let's do a surgery that is going to give you success in this task, because there are people who have struggled. I've struggled with weight since I was 10, 11 years old. Any other questions?
Any other questions? Senator George.
Three words in this bill scare me half to death. Gastric bypass surgery. And they really do, because, I mean, we hear many times that these have significant problems to that person, including death. Do you have any numbers, or we're probably going to hear some folks that have some numbers on this. What's your opinion about that as being something that is suggested will be done?
Right. Well, I think any surgery is very serious. I don't have the numbers. I know that depending on the statistics you're looking at, they'll say 1-3% have serious complications, and that may include death. What you have to realize is that there are people. I was watching a show on cable TV called Robin and I, about two women who together lost 800 pounds. And these women, when I saw I tuned in about partway through, and these women were vast. And I thought this was the beginning of their journey toward having surgery. No. Then they went kind of back and forth. And I saw, I mean, these are women who were carried out of their homes in a tarp to get them to the hospital. Could not walk. I mean, there are people who, they are going to die. If something doesn't happen, they are going to die. And bypass surgery has a risk. Mm-hmm. Everything has a risk. And patients need to be able to assess their life and whether or not they're willing to take a risk to potentially have a tremendous benefit accrued to them through the surgery. I had
gastric bypass surgery. So I know firsthand that it can be a life-changing experience. And I knew when I went into it, it could also be an experience that could result in my death. But, you know, there comes a point when you are, and I was 50 years old at the time, when you're 50 years old and you feel like you're 90 and you feel like, you know, I don't think I can get to work for 5 more years. I don't mm-hmm. think I'm going to make it to the point where I can collect Social Security. Well, I feel 35 now. You know, it's a huge difference, and it breaks my heart that there are people here in this town and all across this state who desperately need it. They need it more than I do. I didn't suffer from diabetes, but there are a lot of people who do, who had more health issues than I had going into it. I felt burdened enough. I don't know how those people exist day by day without having some hope that out there the medical community is going to be able to help them do something that they simply cannot do for themselves, no matter how hard they have tried to do it.
Excellent testimony.
Yeah, I understand there are people with metabolic problems and stuff like that, but I've seen television shows about these morbidly obese people that eat more in a day than I eat in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's got to be some responsibility on them. You know, don't eat 4 chickens and 50 pancakes a day, you know, that sort of stuff. And there's also the fact that they can't move, and so they have people enabling them to do that, you know. So their family or friends or whoever is exacerbating their problem.
And I don't disagree with you. Chairman Cruz, I agree that there's definitely a behavioral component, just as there is for a guy who sits down to watch Monday Night Football week after week and consumes a whole pizza and then has a heart attack. There's a behavioral component to all of these things. But we can't take the obese and say, you know, these other kinds of behaviors, we're going to accept them, we're going to cover for them. But for this group of people, these are special people, and we are not going to allow them the same basic fundamental access to reasonable health care, to some kind of hope that they're going to be able to surmount that problem. Because what happens is that you get into a cycle. I think it was Lace, you know, was talking about how you're packing on. Our bodies are geared to store food. We no longer live in a hunter-gatherer society. We don't work even like we did 100 years ago. We used to go out and our bodies were geared towards storing up food and constantly expending between one meal and the next. We don't live that way anymore. And we're seeing the consequence of our society changing in radical ways. And yes, people who are overweight bear some responsibility, but we also have a society that is so different that biologically we have not adapted to the society we live in. And so I leave it at that. In terms of that whole behavioral issue.
Senator Virgin.
I appreciate your testimony today. I think that there are sometimes other things involved. I think your metabolism, for instance, for years and years and years, even until very recent years, I have been able to eat 3 big meals a day and stay skinny. And my metabolism, but as you get older, your metabolism slows down, mm-hmm. and so you can't eat like you did. Mm-hmm. Now, overeating is a different thing. However, food does more than just feed us. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of solace and comfort and a feeling of security in food. And so I think sometimes rather than getting irritated about the amount of food that people eat, we should try to address what it is that they really need. And I think once people have their needs Once they feel loved and secure and a good life and have self-esteem, they don't need and require as much food. So I think there's a lot of, it's not quite as simple sometimes as it appears to be. And I do think that some family tendencies, some people in families tend to be larger. There's always the joke about, well, I'm big boned. So that's the reason that I'm large. But I do think it's a complex issue. And I think that I want to congratulate you, and I'm glad that you feel 35, and I hope you'll never feel a day older.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Powell and Dr. Olson. And that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. First, before I introduce Dr. Olson, I simply want to thank Senator Carter for this series of bills to raise this issue and get it discussed in the legislature and in our society. With me is Dr. Terry Olson, the medical director at Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, and the reason I like to have a doctor here is to somewhat explain how Regents goes about setting medical policies. As you know, through the insurance debates of the 80s and 90s, the saying was always that some 18-year-old clerk answering the phone denied claims. Medical policy is a very serious thing, and health plans take it very seriously, and medical doctors assist in setting that policy by reviewing all the literature in a field and all the data in a field before medical policy is set. And I think that is overlooked many times in the legislature. In addition, obviously at some point, no matter how good something is, there is always a cost element. Can people afford to buy a policy once you have everything on it? Well, it's within that discussion that I want to introduce Dr. Olson to tell you some of our concerns with Senate Bill 930.
Thank you, John. Vice Chairman Cruz and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Terry Olson. I'm a board-certified internist and medical director with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I'm here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 930, the coverage mandate for treatment of morbid obesity and specifically gastric bypass surgery. My three very real concerns are cost, safety, and long-term efficacy of the gastric bypass procedure. As John mentioned, at Regents, we go to great lengths to develop our medical policy based on the science. And in terms of the long-term outcomes of gastric bypass, it's premature to say that they're proven and that it's reliably effective. Also of concern is which patients really benefit, and in which patients is it an appropriate treatment versus an available treatment. And at the current state, that's not clear. The Oregon Health Resources Commission, headed by Kathy Weaver, released a position statement on bariatric surgery in October of 2006. The consensus of the committee was, at this time, there is insufficient evidence that bariatric surgery is cost-effective for the treatment of morbid obesity in patients with a BMI greater than 40 or a BMI greater than 35 with significant comorbidities. They later on referenced that they would await the lab's report before deciding if bariatric surgery is cost-effective for the treatment of morbid obesity in patients with a BMI greater than 40, greater than 35, with significant comorbidities. The lab's report is the longitudinal assessment of bariatric surgery, an ongoing study. Also of concern in Senate Bill 930, and as mentioned previously, this is not merely an adult disorder. All previous studies have been limited to patients over the age of 18. It's unclear if bariatric surgery would be appropriate in pediatric patients. It's been proposed, and currently there's an NIH study that will enroll 200 pediatric patients. Senate Bill 930 doesn't address that issue. And again, do we know what the long-term outcomes are? At this point, I'd say it's unclear. And again, patient selection is very important. Clearly, some patients do benefit from gastric surgery, but how to select those patients is quite difficult. My concern about safety is the very real concern. Some patients will die from the procedure. Mortality rates are about 1%. Major complication rates are frequent and to be expected, 15 to 20%. Readmissions during the first postoperative year are quite common and quite expensive. Patient compliance with the postoperative program is essential. Assessment preoperatively if patients can truly comply with the requirements is unclear. And again, it's a vital component. As we mentioned earlier, this is a complex disorder for which a single surgical intervention is unlikely to sufficiently address what is really needed for the individual members. As mentioned earlier, effective treatment, especially noting behavioral health issues, noting that fundamentally this is an eating disorder, it's a behavioral disorder. As mentioned, there are some triggers that can induce some behaviors. How do you best address that? A surgical intervention is unlikely to produce those results. Along that lines, gastric bypass is not considered curative. It can help minimize some of the secondary comorbidities, such as sleep apnea, diabetes, hypertension. But as a single intervention, it's not advocated as an acute intervention with a one-time cure. As John mentioned, the costs of the programs to support gastric bypass are quite considerable, and we'll be providing you some information with that. One large Regent client purchased a gastric bypass option but discontinued it after 1 year due to the cost. Costs are going to be significant. And again, I did mention the pediatric issue is one that's only now being raised. But again, by the Senate Bill 930, presumably that option could be available if requested for pediatric members. In reviewing and in summarizing our position, again, I think it's premature at this point in time to state that this treatment as a single intervention to address this complex disease is premature to warrant a mandate tag. Thank you.
Questions? Senator George.
I'm going to read this to you and just see if it's not my paranoia here. But it says, every health benefit plan shall provide optional coverage for effective obesity prevention and treatment. How can you guarantee that? I mean, that's to me, when I read this, it's a mandate that you would have effective obesity prevention. Can you guys, am I just being too hypothetical here, or would you be worried about complying with whatever that would mean?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I think that language is problematic in terms of lacking a definition. What would come under that language in terms of being a covered service?
Do you think there's any risk that the person could sue on the basis that I went through your you know, you said you need to deal with your weight and you weren't able to help me to get it under control? Do I sue you?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, the way I read the bill, you would have continual access to those services. Unfortunately, as Dr. Olson pointed out, part of a person's weight is based on habits. Just saw the results of a study the other day, 95% of all people regain the weight from diets, and many of them try several of them, and I only go on them when they say you can eat all the red meat you want, things like that, but most people do gain the weight back from different programs.
Mr. Vice Chairman, Senator George, I would concur that the wording is sufficiently vague to really understand what is meant by effective. In addition, it's unclear what is really effective weight management treatment. I think that the science behind that isn't well established, and that one could contend that my Jenny Craig diet should be reimbursed by my health plan because it's an effective intervention, or that my personal trainer
should be covered because it is an effective intervention. And as you look towards interventions that can be considered effective, you're obliged to look at those kind of treatments. Mm-hmm. More concerning to me, in the past week, I've reviewed a case that requested to have the fourth lap band placed. Lap bands are becoming more common now. You'll see them on TV. There's mm-hmm. advertisements for the lap band. The difficulty with that is you can't eat your way through a lap band, and you can regain weight. And for a member to say this is the fourth time and we want to place it again, that's a difficult situation. Part of what we do in developing our medical criteria, and we have criteria for gastric bypass. They're publicly available on our website under our policy statement. We do require that members lose 10% of their body weight in a 12-month period of time, frankly, because that is an excellent opportunity to identify which patients can comply with the postoperative requirements. Again, the eating behaviors, there are many different triggers. Each patient is different. If you don't address the underlying behavioral triggers, you can end up in a situation where you regain the weight. And in fact, now we're finding that as the surgeries have been performed, there's a significant failure rate over the long term, primarily in patient selection. You really identify that you selected the right patient. An additional concern of mine is long-term follow-up. Any of these require extensive long-term follow-up. We're finding in the Centers of Excellence in Oregon, to which we direct our patients, to expect the surgeons to know the status of their members at 1 year is quite difficult. Administratively, it's expensive to administer. What we're finding from our surgeons is that they have difficulty complying with our requests that they have follow-up on 70% of their postoperative patients at 1 year. A consistent message is that's really hard to do. We don't know where they are. We don't know what happened. And when you really look at this as a single intervention for a lifelong disorder, again, I believe it's premature to say that's clearly the best selection.
Just do you have a rough estimate if you had that kind of follow-up treatment? You know, what would be looking at as a say like a 4 year cost for a gastric bypass surgery?
It's highly variable for patients. The estimates that we're able to generate, the perioperative costs, the costs about the immediate preoperative, a lot of these patients have significant comorbidities. They're at high risk for surgery. It's an acute dilemma. The higher your risk for surgery, it's likely the more you would benefit from the surgery, but then your risk of death goes up. It's difficult to know. But in terms of a preoperative assessment, many of these members have to undergo extensive preoperative evaluations. That can be costly. For Regents, our experience in the perioperative, again, the acute postoperative period, the preoperative assessment, costs run about $17,000 to $35,000 per surgery. Doesn't include major complications, the subsequent rehospitalizations, and again, it's 15% in the year, 20% major complication rate, quite significant and quite costly. I'd say that if you do have a rocky postoperative course, it's realistic to expect those costs to double.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Very much.
That ends the testimony. I want to thank you. Do you want? Sure. We introduce yourself, please.
Yes, sir. This isn't really to come up to get the last word, but more to just John Christensen, Senator Carter's office, more to explain Senate Bill 930, and you'll see that within Senator Carter's testimony. 930 was introduced in part to have a policy discussion about this type of surgery. Dr. Olson didn't mention, but we have been monitoring. There has been some correlation, actually, between alcoholism and the body's ability to absorb other types of food following this kind of surgery. We are aware there are significant complications that can arise. But it's the other testimony you've heard clearly shows how vital it is for some individuals' lives. And that's why we wanted to pursue this in terms of public policy discussion for 9:30. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 9:30, and we are adjourned.